This is an unusual session
because it breaks the KIGP rule, which is why I'm doing it. So there's no example being set. But I thought that there were so many surveys going on that it would be good for everybody to at least find out this, what's happening. As I like to say, we're investing a lot of money, or somebody's investing a lot of money. I think it would be important for everyone to know what's going on. So we did our best at capturing all the surveys that we could think of, and I left time at the end. And in some sense, that's if there's something we've forgotten or something we missed, which I'm sure there is, please be prepared to say something coherent at the end if there's some survey we literally just totally missed. And so I'm going to start with Ben Chappie on Assassin.
Thank you very much. So I'll jump right in because the time is short. I'm going to tell you today about the AllSky Automated Server for Supernovae, or Assassin. This project has really started to take off in the past couple years, and we've become the dominant discoverer of nearby bright transients on the sky. So Assassin's really a global partnership. We've expanded with our members in the past few years, basically bringing in technical expertise or scientific expertise, which we don't already have in-house. And this is really to expand the amount of science that we can get out of the data that we collect with Assassin. A key member of Assassin is Las Cumbres Observatory, which Todd will tell you more about right after my talk. But this is a global network of 0.4, 1, and 2 meter class telescopes around the globe. They supply Assassin site support and our mounts. The two sites which are currently important for Assassin are Haleakala, Hawaii, and Cerro Tololo, Chile. At each one of these sites, we have a fully robotic telescope that's scheduled all by itself based on the quality of data from previous nights. Takes its own data, downloads it, reduces it, and goes through a transient detection pipeline. This is our northern unit right here named Brutus. This is our southern unit named Cassius. Some of you got the joke. Each unit has four 14-centimeter Nikon telephoto lenses backed by 2K by 2K thermoelectrically cooled CCDs. Each camera has a field of view of 4.5 degrees on the side. This gives us a large pixel scale of about 8 arc seconds per pixel. We're sky limited at because of our large pixels. This sets our limiting magnitude of about 17 magnitudes. This is for actually detecting and discovering a supernova. So if you want an isolated point source, then we can go about a magnitude fainter than that for a 5-sigma detection. What's interesting about these units is that we can survey, with both units, we can survey about 16,000 square degrees per night. This allows us to observe the entire visible sky every other night. And when I turned on the Southern Galactic Plane in the fall of last year, we became the first survey in human history to do the entire visible sky in real time for transients. This is an example of Assassin data. It's 4.5 degrees on the side, as I said. What I want you to know here is, one, that the four cameras are splayed, so they give us more area, but there is a 0.5 degree overlap between adjacent fields. And between adjacent pointings, there's also a 0.5 degree overlap, which isn't shown here. And this means that we do the entire sky with a 2-day cadence, but about half the sky is actually in these overlaps, and so we have a non-uniform cadence that's double that. This, for scale, this is the full moon. This is the entire field of view of LSST. So this is a huge area of the sky. If you want to break down supernovae by who discovers them, these are bright supernovae, so brighter than 17th magnitude. This is starting when our southern unit was deployed in Chile. This is in 2014. You can see that we discovered about half the bright supernovae in that year. In 2015, we improved. In 2016, we improved further. And so now we discover about 2/3 of all the bright supernovae on the sky. One thing I'll note is that Atlas is talking later. I expect Atlas's contribution in this plot to increase over the next couple of years. So I just wanted to say that. What's interesting is that here I break down the same supernovae, so these are brighter than 17th magnitude, discovered in 2015 and 16. I break them down by who discovered them. So red is Assassin, blue is other professional surveys, all of them combined, and black are amateurs. On the x-axis, I show you host galaxy absolute K-band magnitude. So this gives you an idea of how big the galaxy is, big galaxies, small galaxies. On the y-axis, I show you offset from the center of the host galaxy of the supernova was discovered. These vertical dashed lines are the median in the x-direction. So you can see that Assassin and other professional surveys discover supernovae significantly in smaller galaxies than amateurs. That's because amateurs are biased because they look at particular large galaxies because they're smart and want to increase their rate. That's not surprising. But what is surprising in this plot is the y-axis. So if you look, Assassin's actually about a factor, this is a log scale, so Assassin's about a factor of two closer in to the center of the host galaxy for the median supernova. Actually, our median supernova is within one Assassin pixel of the center of the host galaxy. So this is surprising because we have such large pixels. You might think we would do poorly in crowded regions, but we're actually significantly more complete in this region, which goes to our core goal, which is to create a local census of nearby supernovae in the universe. Looking, we were asked to look towards the future. So in the future, we want to do the entire sky with even faster cadence. Right now, weather is one of our biggest problems. So Hawaii and Chile are both great sites, but they still have bad weather, and bad weather is often correlated with itself. So if it's cloudy tonight, it's more likely to be cloudy tomorrow. This leaves you with large gaps in your data, which is very, very bad for our transient surveys. Additionally, we want to make our data more publicly available. And we look at 50 million stars every other night right now. We want to release those light curves to the public in real time. So a couple hours or an hour after the data is taken, we want to give a public light curve. To do both of these, we were awarded $2.4 million from the Moore Foundation just recently, I guess 4 months ago now. This pays to build this public data set and also pays to deploy two more units, one to Texas and one to South Africa. Additionally, we have money from Denmark, Germany, China, and Chile to add a second unit to Chile. All three of these units will be deployed, taking data with an abstraction running by the end of this year. That's a testament to LCOGT really jumping on this project right away. And at this point, we'll have about 20-hour cadence over the entire visible sky, which is four times faster than the public ZTF survey. This is a picture of our third unit, which was recently taken by Paul. I actually saw this on Twitter. That's how I got this image. And the last two slides, I just want to kind of give plugs for future projects as well. TESS is launching next year. It has even larger pixels than Assassin and covers a smaller area of the sky. But when you compare apples to apples with transient surveys, you actually see that it does pretty well. So when you think of TESS, you usually think of very bright targets. That's because TESS is built for planets, and they care about 10 parts in a million photometry. For transients, we care about 10% photometry, so you can actually go significantly deeper. With 1 hour stack, you can get down to about 18th magnitude, and then 12 hours, you can get down to about 19th magnitude. This is for only out of the galactic plane, because of the large pixels, it would be crowded limited anywhere near the galactic plane. Unlike Kepler, the TESS will download its full-frame images. If every 30 minutes, it'll take a full-frame image and download those every 2 weeks. I've been working with NASA and the TESS team to try to get those full-frame images as fast as possible. Then I can adapt the Assassin pipeline, which we're already used to dealing with lenses, we're already used to dealing with those distortions and large pixels, adapt the Assassin pipeline to the TESS full-frame images, and do a transient search on this as well. And this will be really good for fast time-scale transients, because we have nowhere near this area with this cadence from the ground at this point. Additionally, if you want to know more about supernova light echoes, Assassin ends up being, because of our lenses, we end up being very good at low surface brightness. So here I just show you 2 years worth, a year of Assassin data from 2 years ago stacked last year, and then when you subtract the two, you can see this supernova light echo, which Armin Rest discovered using the Kapiq 4 meter. And we already have these images all over the entire sky. There's only two galactic supernovae with known remnants, and hopefully we can find light echoes from all the other galactic supernovae that we know of. And then with that, I'll just kind of list the Assassin discoveries so far, and then ask if there's any questions on any of the talk or of any of the discoveries.
Does the fact that you're finding the supernovae slightly closer in correspond to a change in the absolute rate of supernovae because people have been missing some?
So yes. Well, first of all, it's not slightly closer in; it's significantly closer in. And the second thing is, I agree. I have a plot. Let's see if I can show it. Sorry, it's going slow. Here. Maybe. Sorry, it has all the talks loaded. Okay, so this, I think this answers your question. This is the number of supernovae discovered per month that are brighter than 17th magnitude on the sky, starting from 2011 going to now, color-coded by who discovers them. Red is assassin, blue are not discovered by other people and assassin didn't recover them, and yellow is discovered by other people but assassin does recover them. So it just gives you an idea of the completeness.
I can do it in my head. What is the increase in the supernova rate?
So then this horizontal dashed line is the median from 2008 to 2013. And so you can see that the total number of supernovae discovered is increasing. The actual rate will come out later this year, but it's a paper that's in prep by Tom Holoy.
But just to answer that, Elliot, I don't think it really does change the rate because for real surveys that have done a real rate, we already recover supernovae in the center perfectly. So like say supernova legacy survey, we do real simulations where we put in fake supernovae and make sure we cover, we know the percentage, so we correct for whatever we might miss. And this is a very peculiar sample because it's brighter than a, say 17. You can only see those on really big, close galaxies, which like amateurs might have a hard time with those in the center, but like a real survey wouldn't.
So I would take exception to that because, if you just look at TDE rates, right, like the rate that you get from assassin is significantly higher. Those go off right in the center of pretty big galaxies.
Yeah.
So I would say I agree that I don't think it's going to be a huge correction effect.
The first TDEs were found in SNLS, and our field of view is such that you can't expect very many. So maybe compared to other stuff, I'm talking about deep surveys that really do know their statistics and systematic errors and so on, where the trustworthy rates come from.
Yeah. So then, like loss, I guess I would compare it to. Obviously, they were galaxy targeted, so they're not doing the dwarf galaxies. A huge fraction of the nearby 1As that we find are little dwarf galaxies. About a quarter of them aren't even in like NED, and these are within 100 megaparsecs. So if you're doing galaxy targeted surveys, clearly you're not surveying this. Of course, LOST knows this, they try to correct for it, but.
Like I said, real survey. Monty's going to ask a question while we switch to the laptop.
It's just a quick comment. I mean, with all due respect for Assassin Ben, I just wanted to say that, you know, looking at 100 supernovae brighter than 17th mag is very different from the thousands of supernovae that some other professional surveys are finding, and we can certainly find things within the very, very core in the nucleus. There's no problem.
Okay. I would agree, but you can also study the bright ones much better than you can study faint ones.
Okay, so the survey is surveyed. We don't want this to become a pissing match. Okay. All right, Todd.
Why are you surprised? Okay, thank you. So not a survey, but a follow-up facility and of particular interest to all of you because it's now available to all of you. The idea is rather than a single telescope, a bunch of telescopes distributed all around the world, ultimately we expect to have 27 of them, 2 meter, 1 meter, 40 centimeter. Right now we have 18. They're at good sites. You've seen the map that Ben showed. We've got several telescopes per site, so we do multiple programs all at the same time. The instrumentation is uniform, so observations can be passed off, can be combined from different telescopes, and everything's done automatically and robotically. All aimed, the design and operation aimed at time domain follow-up. Just a quick shot of the different telescopes, 2 2-meters, 7 40 centimeters, and 9 1-meters. All of the telescopes have optical imagers on them. The 2 meters have low-resolution spectrographs. The 1 meters have high resolution, 50,000 spectrographs that are just being installed right now. That's called NRES, Network of Robotic Echelle Spectrographs, mostly for doing high precision RV work on bright stars. This whole thing operates as a single facility. This shows you kind of a snapshot of the network. This is the top part of this is the past 24 hours, the bottom part of it is the next 24 hours. Yellow is daytime, blue is bad weather, green are successful exposures. And the way that it works is that people put in requests for observations, people who have time allocated, Just as I want an observation of this object during this time period, or I want you to monitor this object for this period of time, or I want an observation every half hour for the next 3 days, and the scheduler figures out how to assign those to the different telescopes. So at any given moment, there are 10,000 of these requests in the scheduler. It's making up new schedules for all the telescopes all the time. If an observation fails and there's still time in its window, it gets passed off to the next telescope. And we sort of run in these two modes, the Q mode, cadence-driven Q mode, where the scheduler running all the time can get an observation to a telescope in 15 or 20 minutes, and a rapid response mode where you say, I need this observation now, and that begins in between 2 and 10 minutes, depending on the latencies in the system. So in anywhere in the world within 2 to 10 minutes. The way that users monitor their use of the facility is that they, as I said, they ask for an observation or a set of observations with particular constraints, and they get a feedback page that shows them where their observation is scheduled, what its visibility is at the different sites, and as time goes on, they can track what happens to the observation when it's completed. They get a link to the archive. All the data are pipeline processed as they come in, and they're archived within a few minutes, so they can be retrieved by the user within a few minutes, at least with a preliminary reduction. Just as an example of the kinds of things that can be done, the cameras have lots of different filters on them. Obviously, the idea is that you should have anything that you might possibly need, you just select from the filter wheel. We've done some continuous monitoring. On the right, you see a project that was intended to monitor a multiple lensed images of a background quasar to study the dark matter substructure. It was a 48-hour continuous monitoring observation that has an 8-hour gap in it because it was cloudy in Australia. Not much we can do about that. On the left, you can see an example of bright stars. This is 2 millimag RMS. On a transit for a 12th magnitude star taken out of focus. It says up there the 1 meters go to about 20th magnitude, the 2 meters to about 22 for imaging. The spectrograph, this is the Floyd spectrograph, the low dispersion spectrograph is pretty interesting to imagine how you do robotic spectroscopy. You have to position, figure out how to define where your object goes on the slit and position it there. This gets the whole optical window in one go divided into two orders. Again, we have automatic data reduction that produces a combined spectrum, and yes, the fringing in the red is very bad. We have a position by coordinates mode, so if you have very good coordinates for your object, it'll just set that in the slit. We also have a find the brightest object within this radius of this position mode if you don't have such good coordinates. This is the instrument that we're working on now, NRES. The first of these is actually just finished being installed at our site in Chile. It's a R equals 50,000 spectrograph fed by optical fibers from 2 separate 1-meter telescopes, so you can observe 2 objects at the same time. We hope to have 4 of them out by the end of the year, and it's aimed at, as it says, high precision, high stability radial velocities of bright stars, 3 meters per second for V equals 12 in an hour. And why should you be interested? Well, the NSF has given us an MSIP award that makes access to our network available to everyone through NOAO's proposal process, 1,200 hours of 1 meter time, 200 hours of 2 meter time each semester. And the first of these rounds is just completed. In fact, their TAC met a couple of weeks ago. This was kind of an odd semester, but starting the next semester, which is the proposals due at NOAO by the end of September, will be synchronized with their TAC. So those proposals will be due then for time that's going to start December 1st on our network. The NSF wants to use this as a way to get the astronomy community to understand how you do time domain follow-up very, very effectively, efficiently for the LSST era. So we're also using this as a way to to kind of jumpstart some efforts to build infrastructure that's going to link surveys and follow-up facilities. For more information, obviously I had to go through this very quickly, there's our website, and I want to remind you that there's a reception tomorrow at our headquarters from 4 to 7, food and drinks, so you can see where we build the telescopes and where we, people think we have a big control room, but mostly we just do it on our iPhone. But you can see the building, the rooms where we sit and look at our iPhones tomorrow. Thank you.
Questions for Todd? How many people put a proposal in last cycle for LCO time? Raise your hand high. One. Okay.
There were 30.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Todd, do you want to say a little bit more about the 1 meter, other 1 meters that are coming online? You sort of
pass
over it.
You have a map, but I do have a map. So let me go back to the map at the beginning. We're putting two of them in a site in western Tibet. It's at 17,500 feet elevation. It's a tough place to work. But it looks like it's a good site. I actually expect that it's going to be comparable to Mauna Kea. It's called Ali Observatory. We have two more 1 meters that will go to Tenerife, which you can see the dot there off the coast of Africa. We have two 40-centimeter telescopes there. And at the moment, we only have one 1 meter in Texas, but so we have another one to put there. So once we have those two, plus the Hawaii one, we'll have complete coverage in the north. Finally, you see a site there in Israel. We've made a deal with them to integrate the 1 meter telescope at Wise Observatory into our network with this high dispersion, with this high resolution spectrograph. So time on that also will be available. I shouldn't say time on that, it's really the whole network. It's all integrated together. People generally don't ask for a specific telescope.
I was just curious about the deployment strategy for NRES on other units.
Yeah. So there's one in Chile. The next three, which again you can see tomorrow, being put together, and they will go to South Africa, Texas, and then the one to Wise. If we get enough money to, we have actually parts for another two NRESs if we get the money to complete them.
And the international Opticon time, do you know how long that will last for, how many semesters?
So that's a deal with St. Andrews. They were trying to raise money so they could continue to be partners in our collaboration, and they decided that the way to do this was to sell some time through Opticon. So that's just starting. I know that there's just been the very first call or actual review of those proposals, but I think it'll just go on as long as St. Andrews is interested.
Thanks, Todd. Okay, our next talk is by Mansi Kazliwal on this small survey that's not going to be able to compete with Assassin at all, called the Zwicky Transient Facility.
So in full disclosure, Ben is my friend. So okay. Sorry, let's start from the beginning here. So I'm going to just describe a couple of new things. One is the Zwicky Transient Facility, and the other is the Growth Network. So the Zwicky Transient Facility is on top of the beautiful Palomar Mountain here. The Central Discovery Engine is on the Palomar 48-inch. It's a single camera with a snapshot field of view of 47 square degrees. And that can survey at the rate of 3,750 square degrees an hour. And this is to a depth of 20.4 magnitudes. So I'm sorry, Ben, we're going to discover your supernovae before you in the northern hemisphere because we're 4 magnitudes deeper. Okay, that's all the fun I'm going to make of that. And then we have the 60-inch telescope, which has a robotic spectrograph, the SED machine, for follow-up. And this follow-up continues on around the world, very much in the same spirit as Todd just described, where we go west of Palomar after we discover to Hawaii, and then countries around the world where we have a network of people, really, and a heterogeneous set of existing telescopes that we use for 24-hour follow-up. This is not a hardware project. This is really a people project, in contrast to LCOGT. And I will certainly be writing an LCOGT proposal to make the growth network stronger in terms of its hardware capabilities. Okay, so you guys are here to hear about the quick ZTF technical update in pictures. So this is the Zwicky Transient Facility commissioning is happening right now as we speak. The Palma Transient Factory camera has been decommissioned. We have all 16 CCDs. They all work. They all look beautiful. This is a picture of them in December. Now they're safely packed in the cryostat, and things are really looking good. And this is in the lab downstairs at Caltech. If you were up on Palomar Mountain, the 48-inch telescope, as you may have recognized, the primary mirror has been taken off because this camera is so big, it doesn't fit inside the tubes. We have to cut the tube. So there's serious things happening in here. Our camera shutter doesn't fit because it would obscure it. I mean, this is a camera the size of photographic plates. And this is the venerable, you know, Samuel Oschin 48-inch telescope. So the shutter is actually being provided by Bond, and it's the shutter is the size of an elevator. There's a person. That's Steve Kunzman. But the shutter is actually outside the tube of the telescope, and it works. We tested it on IPTF. We have some other really cool things, like a completely robotic filter exchanger, because our filters, instead of being this big, are this big. So we actually have a filter exchanger that's a space-grade KUKA arm that will go pick up the filter and put it in. So ZTF is certainly an industrial-scale project in terms of the hardware as compared to PTF, which was where the prize assets were duct tape and grad students, you know, who could stick their head inside the tube. So this is much, much more serious and looking really beautiful and on track for first light in August of this year. Here are some numbers. Lars said he wanted you guys to have the specs. So because they're brand new electronics, the entire 47 square degrees can read out in actually 10 seconds. Our goal was 15 seconds, but we can do it in 10. So we'll be taking 30-second exposures. The aerial survey rate will be 15 times faster than the Palma Transient Factory. And we can do a 3-pi survey in 8 hours to 20.4 mag. So no matter what we do, if you just do a completely uniform survey, we'll get 250 points, 220.4 mag, on every point accessible in the northern sky. And that's if we do a very simple uniform survey strategy. Now, as you guys, some of you at least know, ZTF is a public-private partnership. Half the funding comes from the National Science Foundation, and the other half from an international set of universities. So as far as the public survey is concerned, this is for 40% of the time on the telescope. Just in year one, these are the two surveys that will happen. The first is celestial cinematography, which is basically covering the accessible northern sky, about 15,000 square degrees at any given time, in one exposure in G-band and then another exposure in R-band. So you have simultaneous color within 1 hour on every point. And we return to this field every 3 days on average. So that's the simplest survey. And the second one is a galactic plane sweep, where within plus minus 6 degrees of the plane, we return to the same point every night. This is only the plan for the first year. This is sort of to mimic LSST's universal cadence. There's a lot of interest from the community in doing that. But the time domain field is moving very quickly, and people are getting interested in even faster cadence. And that's certainly something that's on the table for, you know, year two and year three of the survey. But it's a decision by the Community Science Advisory Committee and the ZTF board at the end of year one. Thanks to the NSF funding, the funding makes the PTF, IPTF, and the ZTF data public. This is an image of the NASA IPAC infrared archive. And you can just type in PTF right now and already get all of the data. So all the PTF data has already been released in 2015, and the IPTF data is slowly rolling out. And this is just a schedule of various things. The most important thing to note here is at the end of July, early August is when we expect first light. And and November is when we begin survey operations in earnest. And so far, everything looks like it's on track for that. What we promised to deliver the community in the NSF proposal was that in 2018, we'll be doing all-sky reference building and releasing the images at the end of the year. 2019 is when we send out photometric alerts in real time. And 2020 is when we send out transient alerts from the image differencing survey. So before you get too upset about this, I just wanted to say that this is just too slow even for me, and I just don't think that's the that's what we should do in today's day and age. So we definitely intend to accelerate the image referencing alerts from year three into year one. Exactly when in year one is something that is to be determined. One thing we want to be very careful about is that when we put out these image referencing alerts for Supernovae in real time, the stream needs to be reliable. We don't want to inundate you guys with garbage. The expected event rates, as you can see from PTF, was already a few times 10 to the 4. With ZTF, it's a few times 10 to the 5. And with LSSC, it'll be a few times 10 to the 6. So just getting the entire fire hose will not be useful unless we can have a very clean stream that's astrophysical, has all the right things that are attached to it, like the light curve history, metrics that can be used to filter the stream. And we're currently looking into a system that's being developed for LSST. And in fact, the project scientist for ZTF is now a research faculty at University of Washington in charge of the LSST level one stream. So it'll be in exactly the same format that that LSST will have for this event stream, for the community. And we really hope the real-time alerts will come out, I mean, in year one for sure, and hopefully sooner than later is all I'm allowed to say. So with that, thank you for your time and attention, and I'll take questions.
So why not just release the alerts to the community? Because the community is going to have to be the ones who figure out how to deal with the LSST stream. So it's better to let them get the experience rather than keep them hidden within the private side of ZTF until, I don't know, a year goes by.
So we will do this in year one and sooner than later, but we don't want to inundate the community with garbage. So once we know our stream is reliable, astrophysical, we've done our software checks, we want to release it. And what we are funded for from NSF, what was written down in the NSF proposal is that we don't do this until year three. So we already
But that was ridiculous in the first place.
We're already accelerating that, so we'll do the best we can. And that's, I think that's, and it'll be in exactly the same format that you guys will get LSST data stream. Because our project scientist is the person in charge now of the level one data stream at LSST. So you can't ask for anything more than that. You know, there's teething troubles with the new project. And so I wouldn't promise this on day one. But my sense is it'll be very soon.
Can you go back to where you showed just a comparison to ZTF? Is it talk through the filters a little bit, GNR?
Yeah.
This one?
Wherever you have it. So for some of the public survey, here we go. So explain a little bit. It's one big filter at this point, or two big filters?
Yeah, so we have a filter exchanger, so we can image the entire area in one filter now. So basically, we need to get two exposures to flag moving objects in the solar system at minimum, right? I mean, you need to see something move. So we'll have two exposures separated by 1 hour in the night, so you can see the moving object. But we'll do this in two different filters because we've shown with IPTF that even if you have one G-band and one R-band exposure separated by an hour, it's equally effective in rejecting asteroids, but also very good in that you have a color. So you can tell a young supernova from an older one because it's hot and blue at that time. So having contemporaneous color is a valuable extra piece of information. So we'll have GNR tonight, and then 3 days later, we come back in GNR.
Ben?
Just had two questions. So one is the 3 day on average, is that accounting for weather? And then the other one is the magnitude limit. Is that isolated point source, or what is that magnitude limit?
Excellent questions. The 20.4 mag is 5 sigma point source. No, this is over a range of surface brightnesses, I mean, different galaxies, so it's averaged over everything. It's certainly not only isolated. I mean, it does take into account underlying background and the median distribution. It's a median number. The second question you asked me was?
The three-day cadence
is an average taking into account weather, because if you take into account weather, you get something like 6 hours per night on average. And so using most conservative assumptions, weather, engineering, and all of that, 3 days, like sort of the minimum we can promise. I mean, it's actually in reality, it's going to be much faster than that in the summer and spring and fall, and slower in the winter. So you'll see seasonal variations in the number, where it's better on most in based on in the spring and worse in the winter.
Thanks, Monson. Changing schedule. I'm not quite sure why, but we're doing it. Connie.
Yes. Yeah. Thanks. And I have to do two surveys on 8 minutes. That's unfair.
Who said life was fair?
But anyway, so I'm going to start with Gaia. And I have some pictures of my team members here who provided pictures. And you should ask yourself what's in it for you, because that's the main purpose of this session. This is a list of Gaia. You should know by now that the data release one has happened. And that is only after 14 months of operations. So don't expect the nominal precision from the Gaia mission after 5 years, because we've only revolved around the sun once. But it's already much better than Hipparchos. So stop using Hipparchos parallaxes, please. Right? Here's the database. You can download that. For all stars in the Tycho catalog. Yeah. Data release 2 will happen in April 2018, and that should have a billion stars, so that should keep you busy if you want to analyze them. Some spectroscopy will already be available too, and then the interesting thing for the binary community is data release 3, exact date to be determined, but that will give astrometric solutions of binary orbits longer than 2 months, and of course shorter than the time base that has been monitored so far. Okay. 4 is a bit later, but that will have all the variable stars, so we're looking forward to that. Final catalog 2024. That's just dates to put in your calendar. Okay. This doesn't work, of course, because it's not my laptop. What's in it for you? What's in it for me? I can't resist to, just as Jim, go to LOMA stars, because we have been waiting for Gaia for a long time. Why? Because we want to know how good we are doing in predicting from seismology distances in the galaxy. And so we can do that, as Jim explained so nicely to you, from solar-like oscillations. You need to measure two quantities, the large frequency separation and the frequency of maximum power. And that gives you an excellent handle on the radius of the star. If you have a radius and an effective temperature, you have the luminosity. And if you then take into account the Kepler passband, you get a distance. That's what we call a seismic distance. And that's outlined in papers, numerous papers right now. And that has been done for hundreds and hundreds of stars, all low mass. Sorry, we can't do that for high mass stars. Why not? Because Kepler hasn't observed high mass stars. And that's where TESS comes in. But anyway, we are at quite good precision, provided that you can scale the sun, because that's the basic assumption. And of course, we want to know, is that appropriate? And again, Jim's talk told that the cores of red giants are not exactly like the core of the sun, for instance. But for the global parameters, this works. So if you now compare that to a seismic distance, an astrometric distance from Gaia, that's what we did straight after the data release. You see a case of 20 dwarfs here, and it's pretty good. We are proud of this. Seismic distances just work for nearby dwarfs, even up to the precision of the Gaia parallax. This is another case for red giants, but we know that red giants aren't just scaling of the sun, right? But we can look much further with red giants than the dwarfs that are nearby. So here is the latest result. This isn't in the literature yet, but Dan Huber allowed me to show it to you. This is a graph, parallax from seismology, parallax from Gaia, and you see 2,200 stars plotted here with error bars. Note that the error bars for Gaia are still large. It's normal. As I said, we have only 14 months of data. This will increase drastically And so the error bars will shrink here in the x-axis. But it's amazing how well seismology works. So that means that even if we look at the Gaia predictions of the precision, the seismic distance will become better than the Gaia distance beyond 3 kiloparsecs. So for galactic archaeology studies, we're just going to rely on the seismic distances, okay? So that's something that we are really happy with. Now, then let's move to test. Ben already alluded to that, so I'm putting up the tiles again. 27-day baseline for each of those, and it starts in the southern hemisphere, yeah? But there is much more interesting stuff to do than just supernovae, because we can also do seismology with TESS, and we have good connections to the TESS team, so we will have full-frame images with cadences of 30 minutes, but for 750 stars, you have 2 minutes pixel mask, so to speak, and for 60 stars, 20 seconds. So there's going to be a high competition for those people doing fast phenomena that want to be monitored. And moreover, we have the continuous viewing zone here, indicated here, for about 1 year of monitoring. And so if I go back to the things we heard this morning, internal rotation frequencies require you to have a certain time base because the frequency precision goes as 1 over the time base, okay? So we need about at least 100 days to derive internal rotation frequencies of stars that I call massive, and for me that means as of 1.5 solar mass up to, let's say, 30 solar masses, because these are the ones where we have starquakes and can do astroseismology. So we do need to have this zone here monitor the stars for which we can do that. Having said that, these other tiles on shorter periods have also pulsating stars, and so these will also deliver something, but for the acoustic modes. So that is giving a surface rotation. This is a plot from my PhD student, Mai, with all the ONB stars. That's in it for you, right? This is a massive star community. 341 OB stars. Kepler didn't do any O star, and a few B stars, just a few, so to speak. Here we have many more. And this is for magnitudes between 4 and 13. Now, TESS will saturate at these brightnesses, but that's okay. We can deal with that. How do we do that? Well, here's a nice example of Kepler that I can't resist to show, because the one and only beautiful blue supergiant that I wanted this mission to do was carefully placed in between the CCDs to avoid scattered light in order to detect planets. And so the supergiant is here, invisible, but you see it's scattered light, and I managed to put a mask here. So this gives us the most beautiful light curve of a B supergiant. You see it here. I put two masks just to make sure, because it's scattered. This is very far beyond the nominal use of the mission. And then you get this kind of spectrum, which is confirmed by spectroscopy during 1800 days. And I think this is a signature of internal gravity waves, because it very much resembles what Tammy's predictions tell us. And then Thomas gave us the Pleiades this morning, 7 stars, and he said they all look the same, more or less, BE stars. They are nowhere near the same in their interior. That's what K2 is giving us. These are light curves of the Kepler mission in its new mode, let's say, and here are the 7 brightest Pleiades stars. Yeah, some are rotational modulation, some have oscillations, some have multiples, and it's very complicated stochastic process in these. What we learn from that is funny, Maya is not a Maya star. That's one of the key conclusions from this paper. Just to come back, so if you want fast phenomena with TESS, please write proposals, and Gerald Handler is here. He's the OB star responsible to make sure that we have higher cadence than nominal. It's going to be a challenge, but the very nice thing is that we will have pulsating stars in the Magellanic Clouds at different metallicity than what we had so far. And Kepler just gave the stars up to 5 solar masses, except for that blue supergiant that I showed. And TESS will go all the way up to even O stars. So we need photometry for that. It will come from TESS. And then Juna will tell us all about spectroscopy for that in the next talk. Thanks.
What about the crowding issues for the large TESS pixels in the LMC?
Yes, so the LMC is going to be a challenge. We will have to unravel that. We realize that, but it doesn't really matter. We can experiment with that just in the same way as we experimented with Kepler pixels, which was a lot easier, admittedly, but somehow we will have to manage. We will need some time, though, to sort it out. So don't expect public releases in an hour as the previous speaker. That's a no-go for us.
Can you comment a little bit on how TESS is managing the openness of people getting engaged in the science? On the seismic side.
On the seismic side, yeah. So we'll have full-frame images anyway for the nominal.
Who's we?
We. You.
Okay, just checking. Yeah.
K2 is also immediately public.
Understood.
Yeah. For the faster cadence, we have to put in a target list through the TESS Astroseismology Science Community, abbreviated TASC, that is led by the Aarhus University, but they are open to anyone who wants to join. So if you want your star in, then register as a TASC user, and you'll get access. And we are giving open access. The more open you do things, the better science comes out. That's my attitude.
Yeah, I know this. Ben.
So I forget the exact time, but I think TESS is supposed to make their full frame images public after 3 months. It might be 4 months. And I'm trying to work with them to increase this, or decrease it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They need some time to do reductions.
And the full frame right. Capability is a telemetry issue. Is it still secure? It's going to happen.
So
there was a debate.
It wasn't going to happen, and now I think it's back. Okay. On.
Is it still oscillating, or do you think it's damped?
I'm praying it's damped.
Okay, Juna.
Yes, so Connie, that was an excellent introduction. Openness is the key, and of course, this one Digital Sky Survey has led the way in that. I just want to thank Lars and the organizers of the meeting for inviting me to come and talk about AS4DU. So what is SDSS doing for stellar astrophysics? So as I don't need to tell you guys, stellar astrophysics is really undergoing a revolution, and I really think it's very similar to what was happening in the 90s in galaxy formation, where you know we had these hints of large-scale structure, and then the Sloan Digital Sky Survey came in, you know, sort of moving things from n of around 1,000 to n of around millions. And in fact, that is exactly what's happening in stellar spectroscopy and stellar astronomy today. And SDSS has this chance to make a major contribution again. So of course, the big revolution within SDSS-4 is that it is now all sky. So this is the planned targeted field for the full SDSS-4 survey. This is the SDSS telescope in the north, and the major thing that happened with SDSS-4 is that it leapt telescopes to Carnegie's DuPont telescope in the southern hemisphere. So we have similar wide field. Actually, the Sloan telescope was kind of a copy of the DuPont telescope, so a lot of things work really nicely there. This is the planned targeting field in SDSS-4. And just to give you an overview of the hardware that's already in place, we've got 2 optical spectrographs, R of around 2,000. We have 2 apogee spectrographs, R of around 22,000. That's in the H band. So we have optical infrared capability in both the northern, the southern hemisphere. We have the apogee spectrograph, which is now in commissioning. And in the northern hemisphere, we also have integral field units as well. And we're building another optical spectrograph for the southern telescope. This is a huge milestone. This just happened in February. The Apogee South instrument is taking data. It works. That is mega. And of course, in this period of openness, I can't resist showing, you know, you guys are all fighting about what's a real survey and a professional survey and whatever, but like, you know, can we all just get along? So of course, SDSS has a great tradition of usable public data releases. In fact, when at one point I suggested to the current director of SDSS, Mike Blanton, that he, you know, have a day without data, he was just horrified. He just absolutely refused. And of course, most of the papers that come out of the SDSS survey come from outside of the collaboration. So of the 7,000 papers involving SDSS data, about 80% are outside the collaboration. Raise your hand if you've ever used any SDSS data. Good, good. So what's next? So unlike other programs, which just have dedicated lines, the SDSS survey has to be reincarnated anew after every phase. It doesn't have the same type, you know, it's not like a telescope that just has a line in some university's budget. SDSS is really a scientific collaboration, and each incarnation really has to respond to the needs and desires of the community. So in 2020 to 2025, as you're hearing, the astrophysics landscape is incredibly rich. In particular, the era of time domain astronomy, the era of big data science in astrophysics, so what we can learn from lower signal to noise data, stellar astrophysics undergoing this tremendous and very exciting revolution, and of course, you know, you have to have real spiritual problems to not be enthusiastic about gravitational wave astronomy. So what role does SDSS play in this epoch? Well, what are the real strengths? We have very wide field, in particular infrared capability, which is totally unique. We have dual hemisphere coverage with the leap to the southern hemisphere. And of course, this is the gold standard for collaboration infrastructure, data archiving, data distribution. It's really at the forefront. So what is AS4 going to be? So AS4 is the there's a steering committee that spent many months trying to figure this out, and I will spare you that process, but you can ask myself or Connie Aerts, who was an SC member, about that. What are we going to do? So we're doing this all-sky synoptic spectroscopic survey, which is focused on decoding the history of the Milky Way, so galactic archaeology, mapping the emergence of the chemical elements, unveiling the inner workings of stars. And of course, for this group, those are the most interesting things, although I do think that the, you know, low-mass black hole growth is very interesting to this community as well. And we'll also be continuing an IFU program probing the ISM of nearby galaxies. Why can we do this? Well, this is the SDSS4 revolution, but this is using plug plates. So you have a plate, you have to plug fibers to get spectra of targets that you have to know well in advance. It's, the lead time to make these plates is months. With the advances that have happened over the last few years in robotic fiber positioning technologies, we can now replace these plug plates with zonal positioners, and so that's what these are supposed to be here. Each little circle here represents a zone in which you can point an optical or an infrared fiber, and so we're going from that sparsely sampled sky to this after SDSS4 sky. Just to give you a sense of what those look like, this is a movie from the DESI team. These robotic fiber positioners move around. We have an optical and an infrared fiber in each one of those zones. So what does this look like? So what I'm going to show you is what I'm going to show you is just a movie of the, this definitely worked before. Yeah, we dusted it. I'm sure we'll get it. Let's just let it think. What I'm going to show you is the plan for the operations. This is the console. There we go. Down button. Okay, so this is what this is one of those fields with all those little circles, the optical and infrared fiber. This is how the survey proceeds over 5 years. Each one of these little patches here, I've colored the bright time in red and the blue time, dark time in blue, just to kind of give you a sense of optical versus infrared. But of course, you can choose these targets at any time. Where it's getting darker is where we've come back to that patch of sky again. So we are going into the all-sky, multi-epoch time domain spectroscopy regime. And as you can see, there are some very nice regions, like the test continuous viewing zone, where we're getting a lot of epochs. And of course, we're doing, what science are we doing from this? Well, one of the things we're very interested in is making of the Milky Way, but from the stars up. So we're thinking about it from the perspective of cosmology, but really the stellar physics is at the core of this. So we're really exploiting advances in data science to and in stellar physics, like the advances in the seismic distances and astroseismology, to really build this map. This is the density of stars on the sky. We're getting all of these. This is short exposures of very bright stars to enable contiguous full sky coverage. So we're getting every massive star in the Milky Way with H less than about 13. So I think that should be interesting to some of you. The major questions we care about, you know, how do stars live, evolve, and die, and how do they affect the transient and gravitational wave universe? What stars actually host planets? What is the stellar multiplicity across the HR diagram, and what is the role of binaries in stellar evolution? That's obviously been a very important theme in this meeting. And of course, what's the origin? What are the progenitors of supernova and the heavy elements? On that, I couldn't resist showing this slide because this is a very famous diagram now, but Lars, the first one of these was made at the KITP at our program, Building the Milky Way, at a conference very similar to this. So I hope you guys are all making sort of groundbreaking figures. And of course, these are Jim Fuller's recent calculations of stellar tracks. And you know, I think what we really want to understand, you know, we know that binaries exist, and we know they can be extremely important, and they can do so many different things. I think we really want to pin down what they can actually do. And we can do this in several ways, and I think one of the key things is just establishing these empirical constraints from surveys like AS4. So it's a 5-year program in both hemispheres. We're going to have about 15 mega targets focused on Milky Way stars and quasars, doing all these fantastic things, just because my time is up. The current status of the project, these are approved by the ARC, who operates the Sloan Telescope, and Carnegie. We are now actively building the collaboration, and there are incentives for early members. I will be sending out a request for seed funds very, very soon. So if you're interested and you're interested in doubling your money, please let me know. And also, if you're interested and you have no money but you're smart, if you'd like to join or lead a science working group, please do contact me. I look forward to talking to all of you. So thank you.
Questions from people who are smart and poor, like theorists.
It's a lot of targets. We're going to do all your targets, so you're welcome.
I think you said this, but I was just curious, how many fibers will you have?
Yeah, so this is the Apogee spectrograph, because it's high resolution, can be fed with 300 fibers in every one of those. There's another way where you can the particular configuration that I showed you was a 500 fiber configuration where the Apogee fibers were in the center. So it's OIR in the center and more optical fibers. The lower resolution optical spectrographs can be fed higher. We do have one question that we're currently debating, which is how high resolution should we make the second optical spectrograph in the southern hemisphere? And that will determine that. We could also have a lot more. Of course, the Boss spectrographs can be fed by 1,000 fibers. So that is TBD, but we can't feed Apogee spectrograph any more than 300. So in each one of those little tiles.
Can you go back and show the timing? When does the after start?
Yeah, so SDSS-4 nominally goes through mid-2020. I don't know if I have the this one. Yeah, so SDSS-4 goes through around mid-2020, although it's actually going faster in some senses, so we may be able to start sooner. Because there's not, the only infrastructure development that we have to do are the robotic fiber positioners and the optical spectrograph, which are, you know, they're long lead time, but we're early. You know, we purposefully started this planning process early in order to allow that. We think we can be on sky by end of 2019.
Sort of just answered what I was asking, which is that you'll have the robotic positioners, but you have no I mean, the Apogee spectrographs continue to be the workhorse.
Yeah. Well, the Apogee spectrographs, we can take one of the Boss spectrographs down to the southern hemisphere, but if you've ever seen how they're attached to the Sloan Telescope, it's one of these things that Connie Roccasi just like shivers when I tell her, we're just going to rip that off and put it down at Las Campanas. So you can absolutely do that, but we could just buy a DESI spectrograph for $1 million. It's okay. So I actually have to go. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, next we have a talk by Yair on BlackGem.
Thanks. Okay, so I actually got these slides from Paul Groot, who's the PI of BlackGem. I just joined this a couple weeks ago, but no, we can do this. So BlackGem is a survey that's now being built. It's going to go in the Southern Hemisphere. What you're looking at now is a prototype telescope that is operational just as of this month, or next month is going to be sent to the site where it's going to undergo the full commissioning. And so I say prototype telescope because BlackGem is going to have three different telescopes. So this is a plan. BlackGem is going to be three telescopes, 65 centimeters each. Each telescope has about a 2.7 square degree field of view. So together you get a little over eight square degrees with the three telescopes. And even though it's a 65 centimeter telescope, the claim is it can go down to a magnitude of 23 in 5 minutes. And you can do that because it's going to be in a very good seeing site in La Silla in Chile. So you can get to these depths at these seeings. And the phase two is to add more telescopes, and then they could go either in the same site or around the world, so kind of like LCOGT, just wide field telescopes, or kind of like Assassin, just going a bit deeper. So the main science driver for this is gravitational wave counterparts, being able to rapidly tile the gravitational wave error region. But while there are not gravitational wave triggers, there's plenty of other science that can be done. And one of these is what we just heard, a Southern Sloan survey, but the photometric part. So it'll be a multicolor UGRIZ survey of the southern sky. This is going to be also important for reference images for the rest of the survey. There's a Q filter in there, which is this G plus R, which I'll get back to a bit later. And a large portion of the time is going to be dedicated to fast transients and fast variables, so very fast cadence observing, which I will talk about in detail a bit as well. So this telescope, the prototype, is called Mirlicht, and that is going to be shipped. So this is already installed in, this is a project led in the Netherlands, and they've already installed it there at their university and tested it on Sky, and it's going to go to South Africa next month, where it's going to do a pretty interesting experiment. So it's going to be paired to the Meerkat radio survey. They have almost the same field of view. And so they're going to be looking at the same parts of the sky simultaneously in radio and optical. I think this is the first time this has been done. And this is going to be very interesting for a variety of types of transients to get them simultaneously. And you know, whenever you have a transient in one, you can see what the other one saw. So this is the technical details of the telescope. I won't go into too much. Just I want you to note that the readout time is very fast. So in 10 seconds, it'll read out, change filters, and move to the next field. So the plan is to do 60-second exposures. And with 10-second readout time, you can do a field every 70 seconds. So if you want to remember one number about this experiment, is each telescope can do about 1,000 square degrees per night for single visits. And then you can scale that to any kind of experiment you want to do. So 1,000 square degrees per telescope per night. If you're visiting each field once. And so this is going to go in La Silla. They're going to bulldoze this old decommissioned telescope dome, and they're going to replace it. The BlackGem telescopes are going to each have their own little dome, and each is going to be elevated on this kind of structure. So this is going to start construction on site pretty soon. I'll show you the timeline in a second. So the main surveys that are going to happen is first this Southern Sloan is going to start running as soon as the survey is operational to start getting all these reference data of the sky. There's going to be this Q-band, which is the G plus R filter, low-cadence survey just every 2 weeks. So this is going to be helpful for slower transients or slower variable sources. And also, if you find something new in the other surveys, you can go back and see, well, what's the history of this object, you know, throughout the lifetime of the survey on this two-week timescale. And then there will be the very fast survey. So this is going to be high cadence, you know, 1 minute exposures, just sitting deep drilling on a few fields, which will be very high cadence to see, are there any, you know, this is an area of phase space that we haven't even explored for transients very much. Are there any transients on these kinds of timescales that are happening and we're missing in all the surveys so far? And there's also a twilight program. So during twilight, it's not dark enough to observe the deeper fields, but you can do the nearby universe. You can do nearby galaxies kind of for free during this time. So twilight at the start and end of the night is going to be dedicated to nearby galaxies. And then, of course, the trigger mode, whenever there's a gravitational wave trigger, that will take priority, and the whole area of the error region can be scanned multiple times on this weak timescale, down to very deep limits. So there's a whole plan of how these different surveys are going to happen with each other. You'll get different colors at different times, and I'm not going to go into the details. Some of this is still being planned out. So the prototype, Meerlicht, has already taken data. Here's some data taken at Radboud University in the Netherlands. So this is data taken at terrible seeing, and apparently, I'm not quite sure what Paul means by greater than full moon. Some weird astronomical phenomena happening in the Netherlands. We should look into that. This might be, and maybe he means light pollution. So this is terrible conditions. They got down to 20th magnitude in the Q-band, signal size of 5. So the extrapolation is that it's on course when you go to a good site, 5-minute exposures and good seeing and no moon, you can get down to deeper than 23. So it looks like it's on track to do that. And here is the schedule for the project. So right now, the prototype telescope has been tested at Radboud. It's being shipped next month to South Africa. It'll be commissioned this spring and then start operations with the radio survey in the summer. And the reason Paul isn't giving this talk is because tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, and the next day is the final design review. And so if that goes well, all of the equipment for the full system is going to be ordered right after this review is over. And the idea is during 2018, spring, send it to Chile, summer, do the commissioning, and start operations in the fall. And here's the people who are involved in this. So Paul Groot is a PI and a project scientist and project manager at Radboud as well. There are a few of us who have joined at the PI level and want to advertise, and we're still looking for partners to the consortium, so you can join at the PI or institutional level if you want to. And this is a limited time offer because apparently after this Meerlicht starts, then prices go up. So join now while you can. Yep, that's it. Thank you very much.
Dollar is strong right now. Just a comment to confirm what Paul meant by greater than full moon was you not only have 3.5 arc seconds seeing in Holland, you don't have dark skies anywhere. You have lots of city lights.
Yes.
So that's what he meant there.
Yeah, okay.
I think one of the great things about this is, unlike the earlier surveys, you're actually getting seeing limited with this. You didn't mention what the pixel scale was for this.
So the pixel scale is a 0.54 or about half an arc second per pixel, which is about a little bit under the seeing.
Generally, my inner Juna since she left. When you say Southern Sloan, that brings up ideas of like public data releases. So then, my first question is: are the images, the full sky images, going to be released to complete the pie that Pan-STARRS hasn't released? And the second question is: are the transients that are discovered, will those be announced in real time to the community?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that is not 100% decided yet. I'm pretty sure the Southern Sloan survey will be released images to community. The transients is still being discussed if they'll be public immediately or if from some of the surveys they'll be public, or that policy has not been set yet.
Thanks, Yair.
Thanks.
Okay, our final talk. This is by Stephen Smart. We gave him 3 surveys. I think we only asked for 2, but we got 3.
Okay. Yeah, so on the... you going to put it up? Yeah.
He's going
to... Oh, yeah, cool. That's it. The one before.
There's not...
This one?
No.
Keep going. No, that's it. No.
Why does it go back?
He doesn't like my talk.
I didn't do that.
Come and fix this. Yeah. So I think you're missing. So just on the Southern Sloan, you're probably missing a survey, which was SkyMapper. Brian Schmidt. What happened to that guy? You know, he was meant to run SkyMapper. Where did he go? So I think we've been working in Pesto with SkyMapper and pulling in some of their transients, which I'll touch on here. So the three I'll talk about are PanStars 1 and 2. I'll just briefly mention that. Then Pesto and Atlas. I'll mostly focus on Atlas because it's the most novel one, I think. So the two surveys that I work with, PanStars and Atlas, are based in Hawaii. PS1 and PS2 are on Haleakala. Atlas 1 is also on Haleakala, and the second Atlas unit has just been installed in Mauna Loa. So PanStars is the 1.8 meter telescope, degrees across, so 7 square degree camera. So that one's been working since about 2009. There's been a public data release, of course, which you can access from Space Telescope. The second telescope has been built, the camera has been built. It's currently undergoing commissioning. 90% of the operations are funded by NASA, so it's doing an all-sky survey, or mostly a broad region around the ecliptic plane, mostly for NEOs. 90% is funded by NASA, but that is useful for transient surveys. We can't control the cadence, but we can process the data, and we do release all of our stationary transients that we find publicly. So we do have 3% of the time guaranteed for override target of opportunity programs, and we use that jointly with Hawaii to do follow-up of gravitational wave sources. So that will continue until 2018, and beyond that, I think the future is a little bit uncertain. It depends on the continuation of NASA funding and other partners. Also in Hawaii, as I say, the first Atlas unit was installed on Haleakala last year, and the second one is now on Mauna Loa. So this was funded again by NASA for an NEO survey. John Tonnery is the PI. It's a fairly small team. John has the team here who are based at IFA, plus Arm and Rest, ourselves in at Queen's. Chris Stubbs is involved in the gravitational wave follow-up. So the science team is pretty small, as is the operational team. This is two 50 centimeter telescopes. They've got 7.5 square degree diameter, sorry, a 7.5 diameter field of view, and they illuminate one monolithic 10K by 10K chip, an STA chip, similar to the Blackgem. So that gives a field of view, you see here, 5.4 degrees, so 29.2 square degrees for each camera. And the goal is to get to 60,000 square degrees a night, down to about magnitude 20. At the minute, the telescopes are delivering a sensitivity of 18.5 because the Schmidt correctors are slightly misshaped. They have been redesigned, and a new set of Schmidt correctors will be delivered to the islands in late April, we hope. So the idea is that each telescope would do 30,000 square degrees a night, and the footprint of four times per night would get us a footprint of 15,000 square degrees per night if we did it four times. So that will allow the tracklets for NEOs and fast transients. They're split by about 1 hour. This is the typical survey strategy. At the minute, just for one telescope, where it will do these four deck bands and then repeat this pattern on a four nightly basis. We've got two filters, and with the two telescopes, we can either do simultaneous color, or we can do exactly the same footprint and increase the cadence, hopefully when both Schmidt correctors work. Two recent examples. So we can process the data within about 12 to 24 hours from one of the telescopes, and we hope we can just repeat that when the second one comes along. The top one's an example of a transient. So we do release our transients publicly as soon as we're confident that they are real astrophysical transients. We send them to the TNS and release them. And we work with the other project that I'll mention, Pesto, to provide them with targets for spectroscopic follow-up. The top example shows one that we processed and managed to get within 24 hours to Pesto and classified. The bottom one shows one which was unusual. It's dead blue for 12 days. Pesto followed it for a while. It turned out to be just a young type 2 supernovae. So already we're turning around the transients pretty quickly, making them public, and but we hope to do the same when this second telescope comes online. The other thing that I'll talk about is the public ESO spectroscopic survey of transient objects. This effectively finishes at the end of this month, and we've been extended for what we call ePESTO, or the extended PESTO survey. This is a spectroscopic survey on the new technology telescope. The first PESTO ran for, at the end of this month, it will be 5 years in total. So it's most of the supernova scientists within the ESO community. What we were given was 90 nights a year, over 10 nights per month over 9 months in each of the years. Our goal was to classify about 2,000 supernovae. We ended up classifying about 1,000. The classifications weren't really the science goal. It was finding enough scientifically interesting targets to follow. And we hoped to follow over 150. We ended up with about 200 with reasonable spectroscopic coverage. And our goal was to get roughly 100 papers within 2 years of survey end. And we've got about 52 published now. So there are quite a few that will still come out. We've had 3 public data releases and a couple more to come. So extended PESTO will last for 2 years. It's pretty similar in terms of operation. The difference is it's not a full public survey, so the data are proprietary, but we will release our classifications on a nightly basis. It's as well as extended in time. We're extended the science goals. A focus will be nuclear transients, the transients we find at the center of galaxies. There are TDEs, unusual supernovae, unusual AGN activity, and probably a little bit of some GRB science. As feeder surveys, we take data, of course, from ATLAS and PanSTARRS, but we will take data from any public survey, any public or private survey that's willing to provide us input images or input targets for spectroscopic follow-up. We have data infrastructure in Belfast that takes input streams from any of the public surveys, merges them together, and then feeds them back to the observers in Chile in real time so that we can communicate together. So that works reasonably smoothly. And ePESTO will continue its roughly 12-hour turnaround time for classification of transient objects, wherever they come from. We'll release the initial classification spectra publicly. The data would currently remain proprietary within the ESO archive, but we will retain this public aspect of releasing the initial classification spectra publicly. So I think that's me done. The only thing I'll say is we have had these public releases of spectroscopic data from PESTO. We've had 3 public releases to date in the ESO archive. We also released 2D spectroscopic frames for people to do their own data reduction, and they're fully calibrated. And this annual or biannual release will continue with ePESTO. That's me done. Thank you.
Let me start with a question about ATLAS. So given the sky survey, can you tell us a little bit about just the photometry for those who wanted to go back, not do difference imaging, but actually use the stars, you know, find binaries, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so we're currently planning how to do that. So the data are processed in 2 ways currently. So they're differenced, and then the difference imaging, or photometry done in the difference imaging. But we're also planning to do photometry on the non-difference frames and produce. The idea is that there are a billion stars brighter than 20th magnitude, and if with the ATLAS cadence, you'd get 1,000 light curve points for a billion stars. So we're currently talking about how we can manage that data flow, but that is the sort of richness of the data set.
I was just curious about, I know ATLAS had plans to go into the Southern Hemisphere, and
yep.
I was just kind of curious about the status of those plans.
So John has been talking to NASA, and they're likely to invite a proposal for 2 more sites, and he would hope that they would go in the Southern Hemisphere. So it's not certain that the invitation will come, that it would be funded, and where they will go. But ideally, if it was funded, the ideal situation for us as a project would be Chile for one, perhaps South Africa for the other. But there are other potential sites who are interested as well.
Roughly what time scale?
I think it's about a year once the decision is made for telescope manufacture, chip acquisition and build. I think the major sticking point are the decisions, funding decisions.
So I had a question about Festo. How faint can you go again? What is the resolution of the spectrograph? And how do you decide which of the bazillion targets to follow up?
Yeah, so the spectrograph EFOSC-2, it's got a resolution of 17 angstroms in the main grading GRISM setting that we use. And we typically target classifications brighter than 20.5. So in 20 minutes, signal to noise of 10 and a 20.5 object. And your final question was, which targets do we prioritize, you mean?
Yeah, because there's so many to choose from under a given night.
Yeah. Usually the two criteria are any recent non-discovery, so looking for the youngest objects, or other things that we would prioritize would be no host galaxy, fast rising or fast declining objects. So something that looks unusual, this is what we have done in PESTO, is something that looks unusual in the light curve or in the environment, or something which looks very young.
Okay, I would like to thank all the speakers. Thank you. So what I thought has happened, which is that basically we got to the end without much time left, and the only survey that was brought up was SkyMapper, but you showed it. I don't know if there was anything else, any other surveys people wanted to say. Like I say, if you're thinking of doing an optical survey, you might want to get involved with an existing one rather than start your own. Is there anything we missed?
Competition's good.
Yeah, I think we have enough competition at this point. Okay, so tonight's the first time you can see posters with a drink in your hand. So I would encourage everyone to join in the courtyard, and the dinner probably starts around 6, but you could go ahead and start doing posters. Thanks.